Today I want to talk about world citizenship. If you ask yourself, where do I live, or where is my home, what is your answer? Obviously, the situation will influence your answer. But often, the answer is your hometown. You are likely to say, I live in Florissant, or I live in Alton, or I live in Roxana. On the other hand, if you are at an airport traveling in this country, you are likely to say, I live in Illinois, or I live in Missouri. But if you are traveling outside the United States and are asked this question, you would probably answer, I live in the United States of America, or I'm an American. Since we are not likely to meet anyone from outer space, we are probably not very likely to answer this question by saying, I live on planet Earth. Not only are we not likely to say, I live on planet Earth, but most of us also are not likely to even think of that kind of answer. This morning, I want to encourage you to start thinking of that fact all the time, to always have in your mind, I live on this planet, on planet Earth. I hope that you will go even further and say to yourself, I am a citizen of the world, and I am a member of the crew of Spaceship Earth with responsibilities for taking care of it. I also want to encourage you to think about the implications of thinking that important thought. If I truly am a citizen of planet Earth and a member of the crew of Spaceship Earth, what other thoughts should come to mind? How consequently should I be conducting my life? Now, the place we regard as home is an important part of how we think of ourselves, of how we identify ourselves, of our personal identification. It may not make a great difference, but I think that people who say, I am a St. Louisan, have a slightly different image of themselves than persons who say, I live in University City, or I live in Ladue, or I live in Wellston. Or to switch to Illinois, I think that people who say, I live in Edwardsville, have a slightly different image of themselves than persons who say, I live in East St. Louis, or I live in Alton, or I live in Godfrey. Municipalities have their different characteristics, and those characteristics can influence the self-identity of those who live in them, often engendering feelings of pride or shame. But what is true for people living in different municipalities can also be true for people who live in different states. There's usually some pride in one's own state, but there are also other feelings. I think that people who say, I live in California, or I live in Texas, or I live in Oregon, or I live in Massachusetts, or I live in Montana, they all have different images of themselves because of that. But the differences in self-identification due to residing in these different cities and states are virtually nothing compared to the linguistic and cultural differences among the almost 200 different nation states of the world in which people live. Are there any persons presently alive who have not thought of themselves in terms of their nationality. That is, I'm an American, or I'm a Canadian, or I'm a Mexican, or I'm an Italian, or I'm a Japanese, or I'm a Pakistani, and so on. In fact, this tie to the nation state is the main way that most people tend to identify themselves. Nevertheless, more and more people are changing their national identity. Sometimes because they want to, but sometimes because they are forced to do so. But people who have made this kind of change from one country to another are just the ones who can lead the way in the switch to a new way of seeing ourselves as residents of planet Earth, and not just this or that country. Another thing that can stimulate all of us to think of ourselves as citizens of planet Earth is seeing this well-known photo of Earth from space. I encourage all of you to look again and again at that photo of planet Earth with no national boundaries and with that background of black, empty space, and meditate about its significance. Astronauts who have actually seen Earth from space, not just the photo, have been moved to make the most memorable statements. For example, U.S. astronaut Edgar Mitchell said, "Suddenly, from behind the rim of the moon, in long, slow-motion moments of immense majesty, there emerges a sparkling blue and white jewel, a light, delicate, sky-blue sphere laced with slowly swirling veils of white, rising gradually like a small pearl in a thick sea of black mystery. It takes more than a moment to fully realize this is Earth. This is home." That awareness can also be generated by other things like news items about the planet's endangered ozone layer, about changes in the weather apparently triggered by global warming, about immigration pressures as people in poor lands seek to find a better life in richer countries, and about the possibility of a bird flu or E. coli or yellow fever pandemic. It is becoming ever more difficult to ignore what is happening in the rest of the world outside of our national boundaries. This transition away from thinking of ourselves and others primarily in terms of nationality is one of the transformations taking place as we move out of the 20th century and into the 21st century. A shift from nationalism to internationalism has occurred, and now a new shift from globalism to globalism is a continuation of a process that started over 500 years ago and which has really accelerated in the last 250 years. I think we need to think of the context in which we live. New means of transportation, steam engines for ships and trains, gasoline and then diesel engines for autos, trucks, tractors, and trains, airplanes and jet planes and bullet trains have greatly enhanced the distances that people can travel and want to travel. I remember growing up, I had no idea I would ever go out of the United States. And the world has changed so much. I've been out of the country many times. New means of communication, telegrams, telephones, radios, films, television, tape recorders, the internet, and cell phones have changed the way that people can communicate with each other and have especially changed the distances over which we can communicate. Over 5% of my email messages are from people outside of this country. A new world. It's a common observation that modern technological innovations in transportation and communication are making the world smaller every day. Technological changes have also provided new ways for people to gain even more new knowledge about how nature works and about how human society operates. These changes, brought about by new scientific knowledge and the new products of industrialization, are in turn producing changes in how we think about ourselves, as well as how we communicate with each other, and about how we organize ourselves politically. There are no exact times which we can cite and say, that is the year when nationalism gave way to internationalism. Or now, that is the year when internationalism gave way to globalism. These social changes are gradual, but that does not mean that they are not real. There are real differences between the nationalism of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries and the internationalism which appears in the last part of the 19th century and covers most of the 20th century. There are real differences, too, between the internationalism of the 20th century and the globalism of the 21st century in which we are now living. But let me explain that distinction in greater detail, because people still often use the terms internationalism and globalism interchangeably, as if they mean the same thing, but they don't. The key difference between internationalism and globalism is between viewing the world as composed of a collection of nation states, on the one hand, and viewing it as a single planetary community where national boundaries are becoming more and more insignificant. The appropriate image for internationalism is a map of the world or a globe where the different countries are in different colors and a nice black line around each country. On the other hand, the appropriate image for globalism is this photo of Earth taken from space, where there are no national boundaries, and where the oneness of the planet and its solitariness in space are very evident. I think it will help to recall that the word internationalism comes from Latin terms meaning between or among nation states. In this international framework, people do not relate directly to each other as individual persons. Rather, we interact with each other as people from different countries, and typically by means of national representatives representing us in international organizations. Although it is not possible to point to some single moment when the transition from internationalism to globalism takes place, it seems that a significant development relevant to the beginning of this transition was this photographing of Earth from space, which was done in the late 1960s and early 1970s. The best image is what you see here, the blue marble photograph of Earth taken by the astronauts of Apollo 17 in December 1972. As is now quite evident to all, we are living in the age of globalization. But that term globalization is usually taken as applying only to the domination of the global economy by the transnational corporations. That's what people usually think of when they think of globalization. And that shift certainly is a major factor in the way that the global society is changing. Indeed, it is these transnational corporations, more than any other of our other institutions, that are really already operating in a world without borders. But we are also witnessing globalization, that is, the progressive elimination of national borders, in virtually all facets of human life. Disease, for example, avian flu, HIV, AIDS, the internet, music, science, education, crime, think of drug trafficking, smuggling people and weapons across national boundaries, pirating patents and copyrighted materials. Think of athletics, tourism, and so on. Consider how a growing proportion of people are even marrying across national borders, including some members of this congregation and their families. Another aspect of globalism is the concern for preservation of the environment of the whole earth. When we think of problems such as global warming and depletion of the ozone layer and population growth and depletion of non-renewable resources, it is obvious that national governments focused on limited geographical areas and acting separately just in terms of narrow national interest have no chance of dealing successfully with these problems that are global in scope. This transition from internationalism to globalism has three implications for us. The first implication concerns how we think of ourselves. With internationalism, people tend to regard themselves as members of one country and are dimly aware that their country exists in a world with other countries with whom cooperation is possible. That's the internationalism of the 20th century. But in the case of globalism, we think of ourselves primarily as earthlings, as citizens of the world, and only secondarily as citizens of this or that country. Consider the way that most of us think of ourselves first as Americans and only secondarily as citizens of a particular state, such as Missouri or Illinois. Think of that perspective and go up one more geographical level to the earth as a whole and the different countries like states. The second implication of the shift from internationalism to globalism concerns our use of language. With internationalism, one accepts the situation that different nations and different nationalities will use different languages, and that communication will require interpreters and translators, possibly assisted by various kinds of modern technology that you can now get on your computer. This internationalism will also function better if individual persons learn to use several different national languages. So we have multilingualism, which is very common among the people in Europe, not so common in this country. But in the case of globalism, there must be one common language for all earthlings, not only to facilitate communication, but also to sustain community solidarity. We all belong to the same community. Consider the difficulties that occur when there isn't a single language for a whole country, such as with Quebec in Canada, the Basques in Spain, the Hungarians in Romania, or the present difficulty that the Europeans are having in trying to create a European Union. The main obstacle is all these different languages, 25 official languages in the European Union. Technological translation just can't replace face-to-face communication. Also, one cannot ignore the connection between identity and language use. When people do not use the same language, it is difficult for them to view themselves as belonging to the same community. They just can't easily communicate with those other people. They don't talk the way I talk, and I don't talk the way they do. I just can't communicate with them. When one begins to think of one language for the whole earth, the natural question to ask is, which language would and should that be? At this particular moment, it seems that English is on its way to becoming the single language for the whole world. But we need to remember that the proportion of the world's population which uses English as its first language is declining. From about 10% of the world's population in 1950 to about 5% now. Think of that. One out of every 20 people in the world uses English as their first language. Now, there are a lot of people learning English as a second or third language, but I'm talking here about the number of native speakers. There are now 2.5 times as many people who use Mandarin Chinese as their first language. And the economic influence of China in the world is increasing rapidly. Also, even the native speakers of Spanish now outnumber those of English. And their influence within and outside the United States is growing. But a justice problem arises with the use of any national language for the whole world, whether it be English or Spanish or Chinese. The speakers of that national language are going to be a minority of the world's population, but they will have a great advantage in any kind of international meetings. This injustice arouses resentment, as is now occurring in much of the world against the use of English in international contexts. If you have any kind of communication with Europeans that are not English-speaking people, you know what I'm talking about. There's a resentment. Why do those English speakers have so many advantages? Think of how you would feel if you had to use Chinese in order to participate in meetings with people from other countries. The logical solution to this world language problem is to use a created language which is no one's native language, but which has been designed to be easy to learn and to use. That was the aim of Polish physician L.L. Zamenhof when he created Esperanto and gave it to the world in 1878. The use of Esperanto has spawned a movement of idealists committed to the welfare of the global community based on a common language, which at the same time permits the preservation of national languages, of the minor languages, for national communities. The development of the internet has now given the Esperanto movement new life, despite some national governments. The national governments are all promoting their own national language, and none of them are very enthusiastic about Esperanto. It's a ground-up movement from people who say we need a world language. And I think most of you know I'm a very enthusiastic Esperantist. That's why I was able to spend last fall 5 weeks in China, even though I don't know Chinese. I was able to use Esperanto with my Chinese Esperanto friends and was able to get around perfectly well. The third implication of the internationalism to globalism transition concerns the appropriate focus of our political loyalty. In internationalism, the primary loyalty of all individuals is to their own national governments. international policy-making organizations, such as the League of Nations and the United Nations and the World Health Organization and the Universal Postal Union and the International Atomic Energy Agency, are created in order to deal with international problems. But these organizations are to assist cooperation among the national governments. They're organizations of the national governments, including the United Nations. In globalism, the primary loyalty of all Earthlings would be to a democratic world government, a world federation over the national governments, similar to the way in which our national government is over the state governments. Even now, some individuals may have a greater commitment to the welfare of the whole global community than to their own nation state. Remember the list that I gave you from Roberts. But until the political institutions are changed, they are likely to face obstacles as they try to act in accord with their global commitment. They can try to work through various non-governmental organizations, but they may find it difficult to get around the restraints placed on them by their national governments. I ran into this just last year when the International Esperanto Meeting was in Cuba, and everybody else in the world could go but Americans. Free Americans. National governments typically require primary loyalty to themselves and don't relinquish that requirement until they decide to become part of a larger political unit. Something which, in fact, is now occurring in Europe as the various countries there gradually agree to become part of the European Union, although it's certainly not a federation yet. Globalism will be fully implemented only when the national governments of the whole world are integrated into a democratic world federation. So the question for each of us now is, are we ready to make this transition from internationalism to globalism? Are we ready to think of ourselves and act as world citizens? Are we ready to be not only passengers on planet Earth, but members of the crew which must take care of it? Are we ready to think of ourselves primarily as Earthlings, as citizens of the world, and only secondarily as Americans? Are we and our children ready to learn the new global language, Esperanto, which can provide the linguistic base of support for our commitment to the global community? We just cannot go on expecting that everybody else is going to use English. It's not fair. So what do we do? Can we learn all those other national languages? I don't think so. I think Esperanto provides the good solution. Are we ready to support political institutional change from the internationalistic United Nations to a global democratic world federation? Are we ready in the meantime, because that's not going to happen right away, are we ready in the meantime to give our time and financial support to globally oriented non-governmental organizations, such as Citizens for Global Solutions, Earth Action, World Beyond Borders, Amnesty International, the World Federalist Movement, the Universal Esperanto Association, the Sierra Club, Doctors Without Borders, the Democratic World Federalists, the Association of World Citizens, the World Constitution and Parliament Association, the International Association for Religious Freedom, the Unitarian Universalist UN Office, the International Council of Unitarian Universalists, and so on. There are just many, many, many of these international organizations that are moving in this direction, and they need our support. They're not going to just happen automatically. Whether we ourselves are ready for this transition or not, are we getting our children and grandchildren ready for it? Will they be ready for the global community in which they are going to have to live? It's not going to be a matter of choice. Is our religious education program preparing them for world citizenship? Are we and they ready for the global community of the 21st century? Are we and they ready to think of ourselves as world citizens and to act accordingly?